Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out on this lovely evening. Well, I'll do my best not to keep you here too long. Thank you, Harry, for your very kind introduction. Awkward to remember how old I actually am. I want to talk to you tonight on my PhD research, which is a comparative study of aircraft engine production of World War II. When I'm sometimes asked about my research, I often reply that I'm actually working on a universal cure for insomnia. So if you happen to nod off, please don't be embarrassed. It means I'm succeeding. What I want to talk to you tonight is about how the British and American aircraft engine companies built a huge quantity of airplane engines during World War II. And I particularly want to talk about how they adapted the methods of mass production in order to do that. I hope to offer a counterpoint to the standard narrative of production in World War II that it was effortless. It was simple. All the companies involved simply adopted the mass production methods of the automotive companies, turned a few switches, and out the door came Spitfires, engines, tanks, whatever. I hope to take about 30 to 35 minutes and leave time for any questions that you may have. I want to start with talking about air power. And I think, as you all would agree, air power played a decisive role in World War II. It was terribly important for both the Allies and the Axis nations. The combatants in World War II spent more money on aircraft than on any other weapon system. Now, I put a picture here of the Boeing B-29 in a formation going off to bomb Japan. The American government spent more money on the B-29 program than it did on the atomic bomb. And as Phillips Payson O'Brien says, we could look at the war, in terms of the production angle, as a really intense, nonstop competition for the development and production of airplanes. I'm sure some of you have seen charts like this showing the total production of airplanes during World War II, pretty impressive. As you can see from this chart, the United States, the USSR, and Britain outproduced the Axis nations by a substantial margin, basically three times as many airplanes. What's missing from a lot of these narratives about production of aircraft in World War II is much mention of production of aircraft engines. There's hardly anything that's been written about aircraft engine production. There's lots of books about airplane engines technically, but very little about production. And I think this is really unfortunate because I think you might be able to say that the aircraft engine is actually the most important part of an airplane. And without an engine, an airplane is basically a collection of metal. This chart shows the aircraft engine production record for the main combatants in World War II. Again, pretty amazing numbers. The Allies, again, well outproduced the Axis in terms of aircraft engine production. When we look at the British story of British aircraft engine production, we're really looking at two companies, Rolls-Royce and Bristol Airplane. These are the four principal engines that were produced in England during the war. Three Bristol engines, air-cooled radial engines, the Pegasus, the Mercury, and the Hercules, and obviously the Rolls-Royce Merlin. Rolls-Royce produced 100,000 Merlin engines during the war. But Bristol produced almost as many radial engines, and the story of Bristol is not well known. And it's not well known how important these engines were, particularly the Hercules. Bristol and some shadow factories built over 60,000 of these engines during the war. The American story is different because America had far greater resources. We might not realize that in the middle of the war, the American GDP was four times bigger than the UK. And the Americans had more money, more people, more machines, and they relied on seven engines, principally high-performance engines during the war, five air-cooled radial engines, two produced by the Pratt & Whitney Company, three produced by the Wright Aeronautical Company, which is the company I'm studying. Also, Allison built a liquid-cooled engine, and Packard Motor Company built the Merlin engine under license, producing some 55,000 of these engines. This chart shows the sort of a timeline of aircraft engine production in World War II. What's interesting here is if you look at the British production, it sort of peaks in 1942 at around 50,000, 55,000 engines and continues on through 44. The American story, people tend to focus on the absolute production numbers. In 1944, the Americans built 250,000 aircraft engines. But really, I think the more interesting story is if we go back to 1939, America was totally unprepared for World War II. What's really critical in these years here were the French and British orders for American airplanes and American engines, which really kick-started the expansion of the American aircraft, and particularly the American aircraft industry, prior to the America's own rearmament starting. I wanted to also look at those numbers on a company basis. And I'm looking at Bristol and Wright Aeronautical again, 1938 compared to 1943. In 1938, Bristol and Wright were building around 200 engines a month. They were using what's called batch production, producing small lots of engines, 25 engines for Imperial Airways, 50 engines for the Army Air Corps, that sort of thing. They were using incredibly labor-intensive methods, using highly skilled machinists at a very low rate of production. We jumped to 1943. Bristol's production has increased sevenfold. Wright's has increased 14-fold. And when I first encountered these numbers too many years ago that I want to remember, I was astonished at how do you manage this transition from batch production, building 200 engines a month, to building, in Wright's case, 3,347 engines a month. And that's really the substance of my thesis and the question I'm trying to answer. The common narrative, particularly in the United States, is it was a miracle of mass production. Again, America prides itself on developing mass production. Mass production captivated people in the 20s and 30s. In the post-war world, in fact, there's a book that came out in 1956 called The Miracle of World War II. And there's somehow this production record was miraculous. And this narrative still continues to this day. And in 2013, an American historian looking at planning in World War II posted the comment that once the Packard Motor Company had received the full detailed plans on the Rolls-Royce Merlin from Rolls-Royce, they were able to churn out Merlin engines as easy as churning out roller skates. And I would submit that that's not strictly true. The problem with mass production as a production method is it requires standardization of product. It's very inflexible mode of production. And this caused tremendous problems when you get into very complex machines like aircraft, like airplane engines. And I want to explain this to you, if I can, by looking at comparing the production of an automobile engine and production of an airplane engine. This is the famous, in the United States, Ford flathead V8 engine. It was the engine that powered most Ford passenger cars during the 1930s and into the 1940s. Ford was building these at a rate of around 2,000 to 2,500 a day in its factories. A couple of key points. The engine had about 2,000 parts. It's made out of basic metals, iron, some aluminum. It took about 300 man hours to build. And critically, there were three models of this engine in 7 years, between 32 and 39. And there were not a lot of differences, as near as I can figure. I'm not an engineer, I have to confess that. Not a lot of differences between those two models. And lastly, I wanted just one figure I'll put in there, pounds to horsepower. The Ford V8 at 85 horsepower had about 7 pounds per horsepower, and I'll touch on that in the next slide when we talk about the Bristol Hercules. The large radial engines, the large liquid-cooled engines, high-performance engines of World War II, were at the absolute pinnacle of precision engineering. They were built like a Swiss watch. The Hercules, it was an air-cooled radial, it was a sleeve valve engine. It had more than 7,000 parts. It took 4,400 hours, more or less, to make this thing. There were 16 models of this engine produced between 1937 and 1944. So again, comparing that to the automobile engine, three models in 7 years versus 16 in 7 years. The last point is really important, pounds per horsepower. The goal of an aircraft engine designer, which is basically impossible, is to try and get maximum power for minimum weight. And trying to achieve a one-to-one ratio was the goal of every aircraft engine designer in World War II. Not everybody achieved it. It's extremely difficult. Parts of an engine, this engine goes under enormous amounts of stress. Automobile engine operates maybe at 30% of capacity. Engine operates at about 60%. This is old radial engines, not jets. And as you all probably know, during takeoff climb, power levels are going to be even higher. Every single part of that engine had to fit, had to work, had to be completely reliable, and had to weigh as little as possible. The key point that comes out of this comparison, given the complexity of these engines and given the production processes, which I'll talk about, you can't simply take an airplane engine, give it to an automobile company, and say, build this in quantity, thank you very much. Churn out 30,000, 3,000 a month, thank you. It just didn't work. They're radically different, and I don't know if everyone actually appreciates how radically different these engines are. I want to talk a little bit about some differences in automobile engine and aircraft engine production, looking at tolerances, surface finish, quality control, testing, and particularly, the last point, design changes and development. Tolerances in an aircraft engine are much finer than in an automobile engine. Typically, in the Ford V8, they would measure tolerances to about a hundredth of an inch. Normally, in an aircraft engine, you measure tolerances to a thousandth of an inch, and often to ten thousandths. And I've seen one case where actually it was like a hundred thousandths of an inch. This puts incredible demands on machining these parts from steel and aluminum, which an automobile engine production doesn't have. Surface finish. Every single part of an airplane engine has to have an absolutely flawless finish. If there are any cracks, any abrasions, that could lead to metal fatigue, which could damage the part, which could damage the engine, and you get aircraft engine failure. And as you can imagine, I'm sure you've all experienced, if you have a failure in your automobile engine, you simply slow down, and you pull off the side of the road, and you park, and you call AAA. If you're flying at 20,000 feet, and it's the dark of night, and you're on your way to Germany, and you've got a full bomb load and full fuel load, and your engine conks out, very, very different story. To get this surface finish to be flawless required many, many more machining operations, grinding, milling, honing, which you don't have in automobile production. Quality control, absolutely essential in aircraft engine production. Again, one of the principal demands of the users is for reliability. These engines have to work. They have to work under all operating conditions. Inspection was constant. Every single part of an airplane engine was inspected during the course of its production. To give you but one example, the Wright Aeronautical 9-cylinder R1820 engine, which powered the B-17, to build that engine and all its component parts took about 38,000 machining operations. During the course of those operations, there were 30,000 inspections. This photograph shows an inspector at Wright Aeronautical factory checking master connecting rods. So every part was tested, and records were kept. One of the interesting things, if I had an aside, I was very surprised when I started looking at the employment of these factories, and I found that, let's say a factory would have, say, 10,000 employees. 5,000 were actually working on the engines. And I thought, my God, what are the other 5,000 doing? Sitting around making tea? No, that can't be right. Every single part of these engines had to be recorded on a piece of paper. That piece of paper had to be filed. There was an enormous amount of administrative burden on these companies during the war, which we don't really think about. Testing. Testing, again, is far more rigorous with aircraft engines. In the automotive industry, typically an automotive company would test 1 out of 10 engines. They'd put it on a test rig. They'd run it for 30 minutes. If everything was fine, they'd go on. Every single airplane engine was tested. So those 100,000 Merlin engines, those 60,000 Hercules engines, every single one of those was tested. And it was a complicated test. They started out with something called a green test, running it for 3 to 5 hours, different RPM, different power levels, checking fuel oil consumption. When that test was finished, the engine went back to the assembly area. It was completely disassembled. Every single part of that engine was inspected once more, was put back together again, went back to the test stand for another 2 hours, and then only then, when it passed that final test, was it allowed to be shipped out to the services. Think about the amount of time that that takes when you've got to produce 3,000 engines a month. The last point I want to make is the most important one, and that is the level of design changes and development. All the air forces during the war were desperate for engines of ever greater horsepower. There's enormous pressure on the companies to improve the quality of their engines, to boost the horsepower. This slide shows just three examples of the Hercules. Hercules started out the Mark III in 1939, about 1,375 horsepower. Ends up with the Hercules 100 in 1944 at about close to 1,800 horsepower. What's important to recognize is that these engines were very, very different. The Hercules 100 was very different from the Hercules III of 1939. A lot of the parts were not interchangeable. And this, again, is in response to the demand for greater power. When the factories had to change over from one model to another model, that meant disrupting production. It meant putting in new machine tools. It meant putting in new processes. Very, very complicated. Very unlike mass production, where you're churning out tons of product, and where basically the last product you churn out at the end of the year is almost exactly the same as the first. The other problem was there were constant design changes. To give you another example, from 1942 to 1945, the Wright R3350 engine, which powered the B-29, underwent 20,000 design changes. 20,000. These were coming in every day. I went through a file in Washington, D.C., the National Archives, in February, and I found a file that thick of the daily design changes sent to Wright Aeronautical every day for like 3 months. It was that thick. That was just for 1 year. Again, mass production, the standard mass production, does not have the capability, it doesn't have the flexibility to cope with that many design changes. Very, very difficult. How then was it done? How did they build these engines in the quantities that I showed you? Three main factors. First of all, they expanded capacity. Get more workers in more factories building more engines. That's sort of the simple part, although there's some constraints on you doing that. The second aspect was through production, what we call production engineering, adapting some of the methods of mass production where they were possible to the production of aircraft engines. And lastly, through process engineering, figuring out new ways, new processes of making something. I want to talk about those in a little detail. First of all, a lot of you know the story of the employment increases in World War II. That's a fairly commonly known story, particularly the large employment of women, both in the United States and the UK. I just want to give this one chart showing the employment in the US aircraft industry and how it grew. Again, looking back to 1939, sorry, I just turned this off. Oh, there we go. In 1939, there were 7,000 employees in the American aviation aircraft industry. 7,000. That's it. Basically, people working for Pratt & Whitney and Wright Aeronautical. By 1944, there were 337,000 employees. So they hired a lot more people, and there's some problems with that, which I will get into. The really big and important thing, though, is they built a huge number of factories, new factories. Both the British government and the American government realized that the original manufacturers, Bristol, Rolls-Royce, Wright, Pratt & Whitney, could not by themselves expand adequately to build the engines that were needed. They could not make those quantities. They had to bring in other industries. And both governments brought in companies from the automotive industry. But what's interesting about this is they didn't actually build airplane engines in the car factories. That didn't work. What they did was the governments financed brand new factories in England and the United States, hired the automobile companies to manage these factories and manage the production. In England, it was the shadow factory scheme. In the United States, they developed a form of licensing. And I don't know if you can see this. This is a map showing that's not going to work. Location of the shadow factories around Coventry and Birmingham. And there were two sets of factories. The first group of factories were built in the city next to the automotive works. And I'll show a slide about that in a second. The second group of factories were much, much larger. They were built on the outskirts of the factory in large green areas. And I found a wonderful letter from the Coventry City government to the Air Ministry complaining bitterly that the government had allocated the land for these factories in the green space areas that the city wanted to preserve without exactly telling the city that they were going to do this. But they were, and I'll show a slide on these various factories in a sec. This is a factory from the first shadow group. which started in 1936. The factories were built in 1937. Basically, Austin, Daimler, Roots, Rover, and Standard Motors were all involved, working with Bristol Aeroplane Company to build Bristol Mercury and Pegasus engines. These were small factories, 100,000 square feet, maybe 200,000 square feet. They were designed for two purposes. One, to produce more engines, which the RAF needed, but also to provide education to the automobile companies to how you build aircraft engines. And the government's thinking at the time was when war started, when the emergency started, oh, it'd be simple. All the workers and managers in this small shadow factory would simply cross the street, go to the big car factory, and start building airplane engines. And that didn't work. As the automobile companies told the government finally, only about less than 30% of the machine tools in the automobile factories could be converted to aircraft engine production. It just didn't work. That led the government to set up a second shadow group to build the Hercules engines, 1939. The government set up pairs of factories, Daimler and Standard, Roots and Rover. Each factory built 50% of the parts of the Hercules engine. One factory did the final assembly. Each had a factory that was about 600,000 square feet in area. If you consider those pairs as a single factory, that's about 1.2 million square feet, which is pretty big by English industrial standards. Ford Dagenham's factory, I think, was about 1.9 million square feet. And you can see this is a photograph of the Daimler factory, one long machine operation building, a smaller building to the left of it, which is, I think, the final assembly. Bristol also was provided finance to create its own shadow factory, Bristol No. 3 factory in Accrington. This was a much bigger factory, over a million square feet. And what's interesting about this factory is it was divided into four separate units. And the first unit and the second and the third were where the machining operations were carried out. The fourth unit was where the final assembly was. And I'm going to come back to this a little later. Total force placed in America, again, increased dramatically after America started to rearm and the government started financing new factories. Again, in 1939, we were very unprepared. There's about 1.7 million square feet of factory space in the entire industry. By 1943, when the major plants had been completed, that had expanded to 54 million square feet. This is not a great map. I'm sorry, it's a little not very clear. This map does show the total number of aircraft engine factories and airframe factories that the US government financed during the war. Pre-war, the aviation industry was on the West Coast and the East Coast. Pratt & Whitney was in Connecticut. Wright was in New Jersey, west of New York. The government decided, for a variety of reasons, to put most of the new factories in our Midwest. They chose areas where there was a lot of land and had easy access to labor. And as a result, these factories were very, very big. Typically, these factories are 1.5 million square feet, much bigger than the standard British factory. The government also financed two giant factories, the behemoths of the industry. The first one was the Wright Aeronautical Engine Factory in Lockland, Ohio, outside of Cincinnati. This was designed to produce a particular Wright engine. This is a schematic diagram of the factory layout. And you can't really tell the size. That factory is still there today, by the way. The building number two there was 1.8 million square feet. When it was completed in 1941, it was the largest single-story building in the entire world. The building next to it, much smaller, was 1.4 million square feet. The entire complex was 5.6 million square feet. But just a few years later, 2 years later actually, the government financed an even bigger factory. This is the Dodge factory in Chicago, which built the Wright R-3350 engine for the B-29s. And this guy was a monster. It was now the largest single-story building in the entire world, surpassing Wright's factory in Lockland. The main shop, which you can see there, was 4.3 million square feet. The entire complex, in the background they had an aluminum factory and a magnesium factory, foundry. The entire complex was 6.4 million square feet. So this factory, this one factory in the US, occupied basically as much square footage as all the factories in the UK building Bristol engines. Now the interesting thing is that, as it turns out, these huge giant factories were actually not that productive. They were less productive than some of the smaller factories, which you wouldn't think, but that's the way it happened. Now, the other critical thing I mentioned, it wasn't just a question of expanding capacity. It was they had to find new ways of making these engines. And the critical adjustment they made was switching to something called flow production, or line production. And this is a quote from a man, Frank G. Woolard, who was a British production engineer in the automotive industry in the 1920s and 30s. And he helped develop the concept of flow production in the UK. The critical thing about flow production is this idea of this uninterrupted flow of production, of processes. And the best image I can give you is a river and a tributary system. If you imagine tributaries flowing into a river, the river flowing down to open out in the ocean, there's no obstructions in that flow of water. There are no dams, there's no nothing. That's the ideal of production. What that looked like, and this is my own crude drawing of a flow production in a factory, the ideal was that raw materials and parts would enter at one side of the factory. There would be production lines for all the different components of an engine, crankshaft, cylinders, crankcase, supercharger, whatever, to arrive at the final assembly and testing and then out to shipment. The challenge is what they were trying to do was maximize the utilization of manpower, maximize the utilization of machines, and minimize the time or the materials flowing through those flows. The difficulty is, in a fabricating factory like this, when you've got different parts, all of which require different processes, all of which require different lengths of time to produce, how do you achieve what's called line balancing? How do you make sure that the right number of parts arrive at the end of that line and ready for final assembly? Incredibly complicated. The other thing I want to point out is this is basically a rectangle or a square. For a variety of reasons, the American factories could adapt to this structure. If I go back to the shadow factories, the number two group, you had two factories, each 600,000 square feet, each making 50% of the parts from that map. I'm sorry I couldn't point this out. They weren't located next to each other. They were located 10 to 15 miles apart. How do you get flow production when you've got two factories 15 miles apart? Very difficult. The Accrington factory, four separate buildings. How do you get flow production from that? The US factories, not surprisingly, because they were bigger, they could hold more machine tools, they could hold more workers, they were better designed for flow production, were more productive. And they had much higher production rates than the British factories. One example I want to show you of some of the changes is one of the things, again, was to try and reduce the handling of parts in the production process to save time, speed up production. This photograph is a picture of the Bristol Airplane Engine Department circa 1937. As you can see, there's a line of machine tools. In front here, we have crankcases for Bristol Mercury or Pegasus engine. Behind that, I think, are covers for supercharger units. If you look way down towards the end there, you can see a guy with a cart. My assumption is somebody had to come by with a cart, stop by each machine tool, take those parts, put them in the cart, take them back somewhere else, probably to inventory, come back and do it again all day long. And you can imagine how much time that took. This photograph shows a shadow factory building Hercules engines during the war, manufacturing in this line master connecting rods. And as you can see, by each machine tool, there is now a specially designed cart so that when the machinist finishes working on the connecting rod, you can just put it on the cart, which is a lot more efficient, but still somebody has to come and collect those carts, take them to the next process or somewhere else, bring them back, et cetera, again, time. Contrast that with this photograph of a Wright Aeronautical factory mid-war, 1942, I think, where there's an automatic conveyor line, automatically taking the cylinder barrels to the next station. No human intervention. A lot of the American companies, in fact, according to one report I've read of a British mission, a lot of the American companies use conveyors to a much greater extent than the British companies. And if you magnify this, think of that massive big factory. If you magnify little things like this across an entire factory, you begin to get an idea of how they could produce all these engines so quickly. Now, another big problem that both companies had, in fact, both industries had, was the problem of dilution. in skill levels. There was an enormous shortage of skilled workers in the aircraft industry, starting in 1939 in England, 1940 the United States. There simply weren't enough skilled workers to go around. This chart shows the level of percentage of skilled workers at the Bristol factory in 1938. It was about 50%, roughly, of the workers were classified as skilled. By 1944, at the Accrington factory, 13% of the workers were classed as skilled. The average for the UK was around 20% skilled, 80% semi-skilled or unskilled. That's very difficult. How do you, again, the transition from batch production using highly skilled machinists to quantity production using 80% semi-skilled, unskilled workers, many of whom were women who'd never seen a machine tool before. And even if you have training, which they did, 3 to 6 weeks, you still can't take someone with 3 to 6 weeks training and ask them to replicate an incredibly complicated piece of machinery on a specialized machine tool. It doesn't work. It can't replace a 4-year apprenticeship system, which is what the normal used in the industry. So what they had to do was engage in process engineering, two methods, deconstructing machining operations and then developing new types of machine tools to cope with that lack of skill. First, what they did something they would call de-skilling of the machining process. They would look at, the process engineers would come in, they would work with a skilled machinist, and they would see how that machinist operated a particular machine tool to produce a particular part. What they would then do is sort of deconstruct that. They divide that production process into separate steps, possibly many more steps, that could be accomplished on a particularly well-designed machine tool by someone who didn't have a lot of skill. And in this case, this is a woman operating a machine tool, a milling machine in a British factory. She probably, again, had 3 to 6 weeks of training. She's probably doing a part of an operation, which would then be carried out by somebody else. That was one way they could do this and still maintain the quality of the product. The second thing, and really, really important, was developing new specialized machine tools. Typically, in pre-war, special machine tools like were used in the automobile industry are very expensive. And the rates of production in 1938 didn't justify the company spending that kind of money. During the war, with the government providing the bill, or paying the bill, picking up the bill, and demanding quantity production, they developed many more specialized machine tools. This is a tool that was developed with the Bausch Machine Tool Company in Bristol. It is an automatic boring machine. It would simultaneously bore 14 holes in a crankcase for the Hercules engine. And it required very little intervention by an operator. Basically, as I understand it, the operator would open up the machine, put a new crankcase in, lock it, press a button, the thing would bore the holes, the operator would take the thing out and go to the next one. This is one of the most impressive of all machines at this time. This is called the Greenlee Automatic Transfer Machine, designed in the United States. It was developed by Wright Aeronautical, Studebaker, which was the licensee of Wright, and the Greenlee Machine Tool Company. And this thing was a monster. The biggest one was over 100 feet long. It was 57 machine tools placed in a row. And it drilled and reamed and countersunk all the holes necessary in a cylinder barrel of a Wright, big Wright engine. It replaced 41 standard machines. It required 15 fewer handling operations. And the most important thing, it could process one of these things in 50 seconds. As you see here in the beginning, all the operator had to do was place the cylinder barrel on the machine, lock it in, and there was another couple of folks at the other end who would take it off. The critical thing that this did is it saved 99 workers. And it saved 790 hours of production time. So production time using this machine went from 798 hours to 8 hours. And Wright used these machines in all its major engine factories. And that concludes my talk. My last point is obviously the Allies won the battle of the factories. They built far more engines than the Axis did. It was not a simple case of mass production, as a lot of people have thought. It was very hard work. It was very hard work doing production engineering, doing process engineering, figuring out how to do this, how to build these things in quantity against enormous time deadlines and enormous pressure. So thank you very much.